Here's a little piece of scholarly, obscure stuff. We sang the Psalm 14, and the opening sentence is, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." And if you read the Latin version of it, it says, "Dixit incipiens," the insipid say in their heart, "There is no God." Now, you may think, well, so what? But in seminary, we got a lot, big kick out of that, I can tell you. St. Anselm of Canterbury wrote a whole theological treatise in reply to the fool. So in the Middle Ages, he was talking about in his section where he developed what is known as the ontological proof for the existence of God. It was part of the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. A reply to the fool. Just now file that. You never know when it might come in handy. I was reading the readings to figure out what to preach on this week, and remembering what I say every time I preach now nearly for the last couple of years, that the Green Sundays are the time when the focus of the readings and the preaching and the teaching is about Christian discipleship, the nature of Christian discipleship, the cost of Christian discipleship, how you and I become and seek to be better Christian disciples, or begin to think about the possibility of being a Christian disciple, not unlike the hymn that we sang today from Lift Every Voice and Sing. That's a great hymnal now that is available to the Episcopal Church. So I read from 1 Timothy, Paul describing his own conversion and his own way of understanding how he now became a Christian disciple. And I thought maybe that would afford the opportunity to say something to you about conversion and the subtle aspects of conversion, because Paul in some ways is being very subtle. And then in Luke, we have two parables by Jesus of things lost and then found. We don't read in our lectionary all three lost and found ones, because the last of these in chapter 5 is the prodigal son. And all three of these parables are unique to Luke. So more about that in a little while. But I thought I'd say something about lost and found in terms of who is the church for, and how do we understand what that means. Let me give you some biblical scholarship that may only seek to confuse and not enlighten, but I'll do it anyway. You know, I made my mind up when I got out of seminary that I just wasn't going to take the stuff that I learned about the Bible and stuff it, and then act as if this is one, you know, historical record, unerring, that fits like a hand in a glove, after spending 3 years learning biblical, how people study the Bible and read the ancient languages and understand what it might mean. So, a large number of biblical scholars believe, New Testament scholars, maybe the reigning view among them is that 1st and 2nd Timothy are not Pauline, authentic Pauline letters, which means Paul didn't write them. That's what they say. Why do they say things like that? Well, because I mentioned this not too long ago. If you're a teacher and you tell your kids to not put their name on the essay that they write and put it on the back so you don't know who wrote it, that works for about four times. And then you pretty well know who's written it because you know how they write. You know their style. So in the authentic Pauline letters, there is a style, even though they were dictated to an amanuensis, a secretary, the syntax, the way he writes, his figures of speech, all of those kinds of things are a certain way. And Timothy, 1st and 2nd Timothy, does not possess that. For example, Paul often begins a sentence in the authentic Pauline letters with a Greek preposition, a Greek term, oon, which means, you know, da-da. Okay? So in 1 and 2 Timothy, this doesn't appear. Now, that doesn't mean that these aren't authentic because he had a different secretary. And if they aren't, the person who wrote them really knows Paul like a twin. So you will understand when I will use the term Paul as the author of 1 and 2 Timothy. I will say that. My own tendency is to be somewhat conservative in these matters. So you need to know that too. But I feel duty-bound to tell you that. Why is it important? Who cares? Well, you know, because in a minute I'm going to talk about the nature of conversion and how Paul describes his conversion in 1 and 2 Timothy. But if it's a disciple of Paul, it may tell us something about how the churches that Paul founded understood working pastorally with the question of conversion over time, and their pastoral experience as the Christian community subsequent to Paul's apostolic ministry. Are you following me? So that you have some idea of saying, well, you know, just like us, we have to think about what it's like to be converted and over time, and we're about 2,007 years out now. So what does that all mean? And so we're talking here maybe 65-70 A.D., you know? The first authentic Pauline letters, 55. So nearly a generation later, maybe. All right, enough of that, but just chew on it. Paul is describing himself and saying how he got now converted to Christianity, and he's speaking about what a terrible person he was and so on. I get kind of a kick out of this because, you know, each of us has our own bottom line. And Paul was hardly an irreligious lout before he became a Christian. In fact, it is his dogmatism and his overweening zeal that got him into hot water, right? So maybe conversion has something to do with the idea that even though you may think yourself a religious person and have great commitments and be highly disciplined and regulated about your worship and your religious observance, that you might need to go through a conversion experience to soften the hard corners of the way in which you approach this business, you know? Because in a minute, I'm going to say something to you about Jesus going after the religious leadership of his day and saying, you know what, you think this outfit is for the righteous and the good people. And I'm here to announce to you that it's for everybody. Even the ones who you don't think are righteous and haven't dotted the I's and crossed the T's in your mind. So Paul is saying, here I was thinking this way, being and relating this way, and God converted me to an understanding of how I might now be a more effective person, obedient to God's will and purpose for me, and an ambassador for Christ, as he says in 2 Corinthians, God making his appeal through me. And so too, by extension, you and I make our appeal through God, who assists us in this process. The great line that I like in this was that God was making me an example to those who would come to believe. And what that means, of course, is that the conversion that we speak of involves then, certainly for him and certainly for us, a process of coming to. I don't know about you, but that's very helpful for me because it gives me the idea that I'm engaged in some sort of a process, a way, a path, to determine what it is that's authentic for me and what God's purposes really are for me as I move forward, and what I should keep and what I should continue to discard. So the way Paul speaks about conversion and what, as Christian disciples, we take from this is that we're in a perpetual process of conversion. So don't beat yourself up if you don't feel particularly enthusiastic about a lot of this stuff. But remain open always. By the way, in all endeavors in your life, vocationally and every other way, if you can reconnect to that thing that made you and told you this is what you ought to be doing in your life, this is how the direction it ought to take, these are the decisions you need to make to do this, and it gets to be the same old, look and listen for the still small voice that you know is not your own and sort of re-up your commitments. And that's the kind of thing that Paul is talking about in 1 Timothy and that he's commending. Or a disciple of Paul who is writing to a Christian community. Remember, all these letters were written not to be read by individuals like correspondence, but out in a public setting. The way we have the lectionary in the church is because this is what got read at the Eucharist in the primitive church. So St. Luke's Los Gatos may have had 1 Timothy, 2 Corinthians, and Galatians, and then maybe Luke. All right? And St. Andrew Saratoga had 1 Corinthians and, you know, Colossians and the Epistle to the Hebrews and maybe Matthew or Matthew and John. And they started reading them at the liturgy. Okay? Pretty soon everybody says, gee, we know that a lot of people have these different things. Let's get them all in one thing. Okay? So that's how it got started. Same true for what we call the Old Testament. You had the Torah, the first five books, the Pentateuch, and then all the other writings in sections begin to get put together. So conversion is the process of coming to believe, that others may come to believe. So let's go to Luke. Luke is talking, presenting to us three parables, not the one I'm not going to talk about, but they're all about lost and found, all unique to Luke. They appear in no other gospel. So that means that Luke has received them as part of, remember I've told you about all this? Special L. Right. Luke and Matthew had a copy of Mark's gospel to write their gospel. Mark is the earliest gospel. Matthew and Luke had material of their own that does not appear in either of the other two gospels, called Special M for Matthew and Special L for Luke. Luke and Matthew share a source in common that was not of collections of sayings that we do not possess any longer, called Q. Because they tell the same stories. It stands for the German word Quelle, which means source. So whenever you read in any of the popular press about the Bible and somebody says Q, you'll have some idea of it, although when you do hear about it, they'll be talking about Q in a way that you have to be careful about. There did not exist a separate Q Bible or a Q community that used Q. Q is just a collection of sayings that we know about because Luke and Matthew both use them together, not Mark. Mark was his own thing, okay? Luke is talking about the shepherd going after the one sheep. And then we have the parable of the woman who lost the coin and finds it in her house. Now, here's the thing. All of us have to continually ask the question, who is the church for and what is the church for? Are we a group of people who are here to pat each other into shape? To massage one another's prejudices? Or are we a community that, yes, should be concerned about one another and reach out to one another in love and concern, but be directed outward and say that we wish to commend to others our greatest place of safety and assurance? The great buzz stuff about church growth these days is always talking about in the Episcopal Church and the other mainline churches, moving from a pastoral model of the church to a mission model, or perhaps the recovery of the mission model. I don't mean that necessarily in the evangelical sense. You know, I could preach a sermon on all these if I were a fundamentalist Christian and tell you that the sole vocation of the church is to seek and save the lost. Church programs, all of the stuff we do, the building of churches and buildings, is subordinate to convicting people of their sin, telling them they need a Savior, and bringing them to Jesus Christ. That is the priority of all Christian people, absolutely without remainder, and it should govern everything that we do. Well, as my Old Testament professor in seminary said,
you can believe that if you want to.
Right? God forbid that we shouldn't wish to command our greatest place of safety and assurance. But we're Episcopalians, so we don't believe in either or most of the time. We believe in both and. So Jesus is trying to say to the smug religious leadership who believe they know who what their faith community is for and who's in and who's out, that you need to be surprised, because through me, I'm announcing now that God's gracious offer, God's unconditional acceptance, forgiveness, and love is for everyone. And through my words and works and in my earthly ministry, I am modeling this. And so for today, he gives us two examples of people who have sought and found who were not popular in the ancient Near East. Shepherds. He doesn't even mention, Luke doesn't even use the word shepherd. A person who has sheep, he won't say the word shepherd because it's a bad deal to be a shepherd. We sort of think it's kind of pastoral and good. The first 400 years of Christian history, the principal way Jesus was depicted in Christian art was the image of the shepherd with the sheep around his shoulders. We don't get him on the cross until about 500 or 600 AD. So that obviously resonated with the early Christian community. But shepherds were not highly regarded, and that's why in the infancy narratives, you know, they see the star and they go talk about all that sort of stuff. So people hearing this and reading it say, why would God want to reveal anything to shepherds? They're kind of disreputable in our view. And women in the ancient Near East were perhaps not considered the greatest authority about what was the right way to think theologically about things, right? So here we have a woman looking for a coin and rejoicing and being used as an example. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, 15, 16, two summers, I worked on a cattle ranch up near Bishop, California. And this ranch had about 4,400 cattle. And they had two ranches, one in Nevada and one near Bishop, Bridgeport. And so we would move the cattle over the mountains, you know, back and forth, and did actual, cow, dairy cow. So I remember being up in the up going over the mountain with a bunch of cattle. They were all in the woods. We were in this park. And we got down off our horses and we sat down to eat lunch. And we were eating lunch by this creek. And across the creek, all of a sudden, over the mountain comes 300 or 400 sheep with a Basque shepherd and his dog. So he was on the other side. And he sat down to have his lunch, and the sheep were all around. Well, the cowboys that I was with, the old, you know, guys with, you know, a dip of the real article, you know, Wrangler jeans, never Levi's, good night. They were sitting there, and they were making very derogatory comments about this shepherd and the sheep. And it was like a TV show that I remembered as a kid about sheep people by the cowboys. Remember in westerns? Terrible, terrible. And here it was being played out for me right in this situation. So maybe, shepherds and their being not held in high regard continues on in some people's minds, right? But in this particular case, Jesus' reason for using shepherds is to speak about God's gracious call to everyone, and more to the point in this particular case, that a shepherd can behave in a way to extend and perhaps do things that people who didn't see them in high regard would never imagine they would do. Just as elsewhere in Luke's gospel, the man who takes care of the guy who was beaten up on the road is a Samaritan. You know, somebody who would have read that at the time Luke wrote it would have just thought, this guy is really nuts. This just isn't going to happen. But the nature of God's kingdom is such that it is. Now, in the story of the woman and the lost coin, the thing that I want to leave with you is that the occasion for finding the coin causes her to invite her friends to celebrate with her. And it allows Jesus to say that there is rejoicing in heaven for someone who was lost and then who is found. That it is a great thing. And it affords a preacher the opportunity to say that it's never too late for you or for me or anybody else to reconvert and to connect ourselves and to understand that God loves us unconditionally, forgives us unconditionally, and accepts us unconditionally. I preached about conversion some before last Lent, and I mentioned to you that in the New Testament, in the original languages, the principal word that is used for convert is metanoia, which means to redirect yourself, to look at your life in a new way. There is another Greek word that is used also as a synonym for metanoia in some places in the New Testament, and it's called epistrophe. And this word means the same thing, to redirect your life. But in the etymology of these words, metanoia has to do with your internal self-reflection and the alteration of your states of emotion, mental, and so on, about how you understand what it is you're going to do and the resolve that you make to do it. And epistrophe is all of that, but it has the implication that you now are going to put it in your hands. In behavior, you will take that internal resolve and make it real in relationship. So the converted life means that others are going to see now the transformative quality of God at work in your life. That you'll be able to see how that works. So that you'll all of a sudden discover that perhaps your rough edges are getting a little bit smoother. Other people are beginning to know that. And lo and behold, they're going to say, you know, I've been watching you and seeing you operate, and I want to know how to get what you have. I want you to help me because I need some sense of serenity or clarity about whatever. And that's going to be a moment where you'll be able to be a real evangelist, whether there's one religious term used in the course of this or not. It's godly work. So give thanks this week for God's converting power. Remember that conversion is a process, and that all of us are coming to believe. It isn't just something that the loss is. See if you have the opportunity to reach out to somebody who's lost or suffering.